Is it December already? Actually, no, it isn't. It's the middle of November. But according to the front page of the latest F1 racing magazine out on the newsstands today, it is December. And so, about that podcasting hiatus we were supposed to be on, well, we're doing shrugs here in the studio. Let's put it, how to put it diplomatically, the T's are still being dotted and the I's crossed on the contractual
negotiations. It's the other way
around, isn't it? So.
Who dots their T's?
Oh, I've seen your handwriting.
I think this is the problem with the contract, I think, is if someone's been dotting the T's, must be in a foreign language.
And this is a contractual expert.
Exactly. The proofreading's gone out the window. Well, I'm afraid when it comes to contracts, the proofreading's in the pudding, and that pudding isn't out of the oven yet, so we are not moving just yet. We will be at some point in the near future. So not only are we not quite going on hiatus just yet, we're going to be dropping some bonus audio in the next few days, because it's 10 years since Braun GP won the World Championship, slightly against expectations, and then went on to become the all-conquering winning machine that is Mercedes. It's just won a sixth Constructors' Championship. And we've got an in-depth feature about that. Former CEO Nick Fry dropped into the office for a chat a few weeks ago, and the edited highlights of that is in this month's issue of F1 Racing. But we talked for an hour. There was loads of interesting stuff that we didn't have room for on the page. So we're going to be dropping that in the form of bonus audio in the next few days when I get around to recording an introduction for it. So that should be fun. Mention of this month's magazine on the newsstand today brings me to my guests. To my right, for those of you who are devotees of the Nicholas Parsons programme, just a minute, and love to know where people are sitting, so the very sickly Ben Anderson.
As you can tell, my voice is not at peak performance.
You sound like you've got much more gravitas. But actually,
excellent.
For gravitas, we rely on the person to my left on a computer screen, Mark Gallagher.
Hello, how are you?
I'm adequate. I'm about the only person in this room who isn't ill. So stay away, Ben.
We can change that.
We can just cough all over me. I hope you're not a microphone licker like Lando Norris. But anyway, enough of this sophistry. Mark, you celebrate your first cover feature in this issue, don't you?
No idea how that happened. Ben, what happened? Did someone else turn it down or?
No, you were...
that pause answered the question, actually.
I think, well, what we kind of thought, Lewis is going to be world champion. We've already written to, you know, everybody's written about his driving style, what he brings to the party, all that sort of thing. It's just kind of a subject that's been done to death. So we thought we would take a look at his crossover appeal to the world outside of Formula One, where he's creating a formidable business empire. And who better to write about matters of that ilk rather than friction circles and gentle firm and soft U's rather than hard V's at the apex than you?
Yeah, I think that's a fair summary, Codders. Yeah.
That was good. Did I succeed?
Yeah,
did I succeed?
I'm mopping my brow right now. I'm not like Prince Andrew, I sweat.
I would say, Mark, that you passed the Mrs. Anderson test of feature interest. She read the story from a pre-released copy of F1 Racing that we had delivered to the office.
I quake with fear at the thought of my stuff being read by Mrs. Anderson, and a little bit like what's-his-face in Gladiator, the thumb goes up or the thumb goes down.
If I'd known she was approving it, I would have put more effort into it.
You did an excellent job for a half-assed effort.
So yeah, let's talk about it. Because there were some very interesting statistics in there that you obviously got from Wikipedia, such as...
Thanks very much.
I loved the thing, which is his value is kind of in excess of what you'd expect from someone who drives around in circles for a living. A single social media post by Lewis is worth $40,000. So the question is, where does that come from?
So that comes from the size of the audience that he reaches on social media through his direct followers. But then there is a wider network. As we all know, social media is all about your ultimate reach through, including through people who follow you and people who repost or who like what you're posting. So, for example, Justin Bieber will like a Lewis Hamilton post. That immediately will get communicated to Justin Bieber's huge fan base. So the reality is that the power behind Lewis Hamilton is not just Lewis himself, which is formidable, but also the network that he has. And as I say in the piece, if you take Lewis and his top 20 kind of online friends on social media, there's a billion people out there, a billion social media users who follow that very small group of 20 high-profile musicians and actors and sports people of whom Lewis is one. And that there's a huge power behind that, and that explains his popularity with the brands, the companies who choose to associate themselves with him because of his reach beyond Formula One. So Formula One itself is great, but it is, you know, it is a niche sport in many countries around the world. So Lewis has gone beyond Formula One into creating a truly global platform, and you only have to follow him very briefly on social media just to see the extraordinary reach that he has and the appeal that he has to not just Formula One fans, but to a much wider audience.
It's interesting how unfiltered he can be on social media, isn't it? Like the one a few weeks ago where he woke up in the middle of the night fretting about the state of the world and said we need to save the planet. And he was lampooned for that, probably because maybe he hadn't thought through the implications of being someone who travels the world to drive cars around in circles. But at the same time, it was actually quite interesting. It was an interesting insight into his mindset that he actually does care about that sort of thing. And even if maybe you can criticise his position, given what he does for a living, the fact that it's actually entered his mindset is actually quite a good thing.
While I was writing the piece, that whole thing happened around Lewis posting about saving the planet. And I was really irritated by the subsequent media response and social media response, because Lewis Hamilton's perfectly entitled to, you know, be vegan, to be concerned about the planet. And when people say, oh, well, you know, how can you be a racing driver and be worried about the planet? I mean, I took 146 flights last year. I'm not particularly proud of my carbon footprint, and I'd like to do something to reduce it. I personally think, you know, people blame my generation of boomers for doing it, but yeah, okay, if we have destroyed the planet, it needs to be fixed. And I think Lewis using his platform to, you know, to say what's on his mind is good. And the really important thing, Stuart, here is that the reason he has such a following is that when you see a Lewis Hamilton post, you know, 95% of the time it's an authentic personal post, and that authenticity is so important. It's not being posted by his management company. It's not being posted by a PR agency. It's not being posted by a sponsor. It's Lewis Hamilton with his thoughts coming through. And I think that's why he's got such a following. And I think that's been a very positive thing for him.
That's the point that I was going to emphasise. Well, I get my chance now, don't I? Mark put it very eloquently. It's this unfiltered aspect to Lewis. When you deal with him in more traditional media circumstances, press conferences, media briefings and the like, you get the sense that he speaks his mind, he tries to speak from the heart, and he often gets himself tied up because he'll speak in an unfiltered way, and then sometimes what you read back or listen back to is slightly confused because the points are coming into his head and he's almost blurting them out without.
He just kind of digress and he can meander a little bit off topic and come back to it.
Yeah, it's train of thought, stream of consciousness, and I think that works really well on these social media platforms because you are seeing the real Lewis Hamilton. This is how he feels. This is how he thinks. This is how he speaks. But for someone in his position, with such a track record of success and such a massive global following, there's a big responsibility there. And he has landed himself in hot water in the past in terms of the nature of some of his posts and some of the comments he's made that have been, you know, related to his own family. And people have piled on, Collars, as you know, going below the line,
yes.
As you would say on YouTube. It can be
the bottom half of the internet.
It can be a scary and dark place to tread. And I mean, Lewis has mentioned, hasn't he, I think it was in Austin, about battling some demons himself this year, and everyone has things to deal with. And I wonder if that might be connected to the fact that he's out there so much. And in this current world we live in, people just pile on to your opinions and viewpoints if you stick your head above the parapet like Lewis has. And that's very hard to deal with for anybody, even if you've got, you know, lots of success, lots of money, lots of fans, lots of friends. It's a mentally draining thing to do, to be putting yourself out there in front of millions and millions and millions of people and saying what you think.
Very often people will argue with you on social media without actually disagreeing, if you see what I mean. It's quite bizarre. You'll say something and they'll say, no, you're wrong, and then say something that's actually not quite germane to that point, as if they're basically just reacting to a sentiment you might have expressed. On the evening of the Grand Prix, I tweeted after Lewis said in the podium, the pre-podium thing, he had basically admitted responsibility for the Albon shunt. I sort of lightheartedly said, as any insurance company will tell you, never admit liability. And, you know, a lot of people replied saying, but, you know, he wasn't at fault. There was a door and the door was open and he went for it. It just shut again. Well, it's not what I'm saying. What I said was, never admit liability. I kind of think sometimes people don't, because their attention spans are so short and there's so much crap coming through on Twitter that they don't really sort of interrogate what you're necessarily saying. So maybe Lewis gets a little bit of that with his unfiltered posts. People don't really get to the heart of what he's trying to say.
People often want to just make their own opinion heard, don't they? They're not really interested in having a conversation. They just want to shout louder than the previous person. So you just end up in this weird individual echo chamber where everybody's shouting at themselves. Yeah. But if only your Top of the Pops tweets were worth £40,000 of pop codders.
God, I'd be rolling in it just in a single lunchtime. No one argues with me about, no one disputes my veracity with my live tweeting of old Top of the Pops episodes, apart from it was pointed out to me that I'd got the lineup of Womack and Womack slightly wrong a few weeks ago. But anyhow, moving on, who actually do we think runs Lewis Hamilton PLC, as it were? Because Lewis is someone who, he admits that he has a poor memory for stuff like facts. You know, you ask him about races he's been in and he can't quite remember what happened. He's very much someone who lives in the moment. So he kind of doesn't strike me as someone who does strategy, as it were, in terms of business. So what's his support network like? We know he's got Mark Hines and Alan Colby in his back office, amongst other people. Who's sort of helping him out and helping him form these key relationships, or is it just basically happening organically?
So Mark Hines, who you mention, is someone who's very close to Lewis, travels to the races with him. I've had reason to do some business with Lewis, and you know, Mark has handled that impeccably for Lewis. And then there is a support staff in the office in London. I think one of the things which I found very interesting in researching the article was that progression of Lewis's management from his father. I think, as most people who've followed Lewis's career will know, that he was managed by his father, then he split and there was something of a fallout. Fortunately, they made up again, and that's been great to see. He then had moved to Simon Fuller's 19 group, which you know, was very high profile at the time. It's still a very successful company today, but back in those days, you know, it was really at the forefront of the sort of celebrity management genre of management. So
this was the early days of Lewis's Mercedes contract. Is that
yeah,
right?
It was actually back to McLaren. Back to McLaren times, because actually it was at the end of 2014. So after he'd been at Mercedes a while, that he then moved to the Endeavour Group. And the Endeavour Group, the bit of the Endeavour Group that he went to then was a William Morris agency, very famous agency based in Los Angeles. And I remember that was kind of really an interesting move, because you're talking about a company which, as the management of his sporting career, they definitely had substantial capability on that front. But the really interesting thing about the William Morris agency was their reach across the whole of the sort of celebrity media platform, particularly in the United States. I mean, they're a global agency, but obviously their particular reach in the United States is formidable. So this would explain the way in which Lewis was then being introduced to more of the A-list set that he has been able to develop some very good friendships within. And that had a substantial, I think, impact on his profile. So when you see the types of people that he was then turning up at races with, or chat shows that he was being invited on to, people that he was in the company with at very high profile social events in the United States, a lot of that will have come down to the reach that the William Morris Agency had. Now, that contract came to an end, and Lewis has his own company in London, and they run his whole life in terms of his professional life. It goes under the very nice name of Project 44, and Mark and Ellen and the team there, their team of their administrator, and I'm sure there's legal support within that operation. Essentially, what you're seeing is someone who's taken control of his own career after many years of being in the hands of others who were managing him. And I think that's, again, quite a natural progression that happens with top sports people. They go through that whole learning phase, and then they get to the point where Lewis is now in his mid-30s. He knows what he likes, he knows what he doesn't like. He's probably had contracts that he maybe hasn't enjoyed some of the elements of that. He also knows the people within the Formula One community extremely well. So if a contract has to be negotiated with, you know, Mercedes or Ferrari or whoever he decides to drive for prior to the end of his career, I'm sure he feels well equipped to do that. And really and truthfully, once you've got an extremely capable commercial lawyer working with you, you can negotiate contracts, you know, pretty straightforwardly.
I have to say, I think you did an excellent job with this piece, Mark. And it was fascinating to read about a side of Lewis's life that people have heard strands of and bits and pieces, but it hasn't really been tied together in this way before. And for those who might argue that, oh, you know, what, who cares about the off-track stuff? Why is this relevant? You know, we only care about Lewis the driver. I think it's important to emphasise that this is all part of a bigger picture. The stuff that Lewis does off-track, we know, feeds some of his behaviour on track and some of the things he says. But also, there is an important element, and you touched on it in your last answer, about him laying the foundations for his life after racing. And some of the most successful drivers in Formula One history, and I'm thinking particularly of Jackie Stewart, you know, they have gone on in their careers long after they stopped driving because they dealt with all elements of being a Formula One world champion. They didn't just focus only on the driving and shut the rest of the world out. Lewis is building something that's bigger than just his driving career, but that is also related to it.
I suppose at the beginning of your career, you you have everything done for you, don't you? As a young driver, you probably, you start off, you're in your teens, you've had a father stroke, some other Svengali figure do everything for you. And there kind of comes a time where you either carry on having everything done for you, or you start to take a little bit more of it in-house. And I wonder if Lewis has at some point become aware of the sort of the madness and the feeding frenzy around him, and has made that conscious decision to take it in-house and start Project 44. Because I just remember many years ago, I think it was probably about 2012, because it was just before the Olympics, when I was working as a freelancer, and I was doing some work for Santander UK's PR agency, and they were making a video of the London Grand Prix, if you recall that, sort of they'd drawn a circuit around central London. The whole idea was to sort of try and ride a little bit on the coattails of the Olympics and get the message out there. And we filmed this thing in some fancy bathroom and toilet showroom somewhere near Imperial Wharf.
Glamorous.
Oh, it was very glamorous. And but the actual building itself, because it's chic porcelain. So it's not your Sturmey Archer or whatever. Sturmey Archer make bicycle gears. I'm thinking Ideal Standard. It's not your usual sort of toiletry.
Who did you have sat on the throne?
But we filmed, because it was weird. It was like a cave. But you had Jensen turn up with...
Oh, so Jensen sat on the throne.
He was first on the throne. Jensen turned up with Jessica, I think he was going out with at the time. Lewis turned up with this entire retinue from 19 management, literally, you know, makeup artists and this whole sort of entourage, and he looked a bit weirded out and uncomfortable about it all. And of course, these people were actually quite irksome during filming, because they'd be trying to do a take and you'd just hear this distant clacking of high heels and some woman cackling and yattering about, do you remember that time when we all went off with Posh Spice to Bahrain or something like that? And the director would go, quiet on set, please. Lewis must at some point have realised that, firstly, he was paying for all these people to just flit around and be a bit of a pain in the neck, but also that there has to be a better way of organising your affairs than to have such an absurd entourage.
This kind of picks up off our discussion a couple of months ago around the Daniel Ricciardo fallout with his previous manager, which incidentally, Ben, our discussion turned out to be spot on. He settled that case very nicely, so that was good. But the point is that, again, Daniel Ricciardo's gone from having a bloke who's a friend kind of managing him to, you know, he's now swung the pendulum across to having a big management company's creative artists looking after him. And so drivers do go through this cycle. You know, they start with the dad or the friend, as you say, Stuart, and then they end up with the big management company. And I've seen this so many times where you get to a point where you can almost literally see the driver looking at the people sitting around a table and thinking, wow, I'm paying the salaries of all these people. And
do or I not. Really,
or not. You know, do I really need to be, paying for all of this? And it is shocking. I mean, I had a driver not so long ago tell me that he suddenly went through his accounts in some detail with his management company and discovered that his personal assistant was effectively costing them £200,000 a year. Now,
nice work if you can get it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you can get a male or female assistant, you know, managing your diary and booking your events for a lot less than that. You know, so the reality is, these fees can build up to a point where you start to think, yes, I'm earning a lot of money, but I'm actually also shelling out a fortune for this entourage. And then a bit of reality kicks in. I think that it's interesting what Lewis has done, because he clearly will feel that he's now established a great network already. So he doesn't need a William Morris or anyone else, introducing him to more people, because actually he's got an amazing network already. And he's on that A-list invitation listing in the United States, which...
US of A-list, as you expert.
Oh, the US of A-list. Did you like that? Yeah,
that
suddenly flourish. Came to me. Yeah, flourish, little flourish there. But anyway, yeah, so it is very interesting. And I think, again, it's a sign of his, you know... I mean, he's been a mature man for many years, but it's a sign of his commercial maturity that he feels he can sit down... himself opposite Toto or Mattia Bonotto or whoever he's negotiating with, and then with the help of a small team of people, make it all happen. And that's the way it should be.
And there's a lovely theme running through the feature as well of Lewis, as you mentioned, Codders, taking kind of ownership of his own affairs, but also channeling that in a positive way to take on the critics, to take on the haters, as he would call them. And you mentioned, Mark, as well, you know, some of this environmental activism, opening a chain of vegan burger restaurants with other partners. You know, he's whatever it be, whether it be media criticism or social media criticism or the like, he's trying to harness all of that energy, which he would call negative energy, and channel it into a positive result. And that you see manifested, I think, also when he's on the track or he's at the races, because his performance has gone up, even though all of these other things that he has to do seem to have grown exponentially over the last few years.
But I really like what you said a few moments ago, Ben, around the fact that there are, you know, there are fans who will say, well, all these distractions have nothing to do with Lewis the driver. Lewis the driver is the person that I'm interested in. Lewis the person is the whole being, and his driving ability is partly due to the fact that he is such a confident individual because of the world that he's built around him. And there's kind of, I think a few years ago, there was a kind of a grudging acceptance that the distractions were actually not a distraction for Lewis. They actually make him stronger. And now in the last couple of years, you have none other than Toto Wolff repeatedly saying in interviews, one of the reasons Lewis is so strong is that he has so many wonderful interests beyond Formula One. When he turns up at the racetrack, he's refreshed, he's focused, he can't wait to get back in the car because he's effectively had a complete break from it. And I think for Lewis, it really, really works. So it's an interesting one. I think it kind of goes against everything you tend to previously read about sports people who, you know, if they get focused on other things, it's a distraction. You know, if you think about, you know, Eddie Irvine, or you think about, you know, maybe his slight lack of focus, or Michael Schumacher and his laser-like focus on just Formula One, was just Formula One the whole time. But this worked for Lewis, and that's the important thing, and the results speak for themselves. And I think the sort of final point I'd make on the article is that when I was writing it, I was thinking, where is he going to be in 10 years' time, 20 years' time, 30 years' time, 40 years' time? You know, because when you talk about Jackie Stewart and the you know, commercial success that he had beyond Formula One, the reality is Lewis Hamilton has, you know, hopefully a good 50 years ahead of him. And during that time, he'll always be 6 or 7 or 8 times world champion and be in huge demand. So he's got a massive opportunity in front of him, and he's right to put all of those blocks in place now.
Indeed, it's 50th anniversary this year of Jackie Stewart's first world championship, and a man who's never been away from Formula One since, basically, in some way, shape or form. So hopefully Lewis, if he does hang up his helmet, will still keep some sort of involvement in the business.
It's a pity Jackie doesn't quite get Lewis. He will kind of make a point about Lewis being having great results and being a very capable driver, but he just holds back a bit. And I think Jackie, It's a pity he doesn't perhaps fully understand why the Lewis Hamilton character, in with all of its traits, is what makes Lewis so strong. And it's changed times from Jackie's days in so many ways. And it'd be nice to think that Jackie could really understand the extent to which all of these apparent distractions that we're talking about are actually not distractions for Lewis Hamilton. They're actually one of the reasons he's so damn strong.
I suppose it's because he's different, isn't he?
Yeah, unconventional, I was going to say. Mm. Yeah, he's doing things that kind of no other Formula One driver has really done. Like, there's no one else who's really been on that A-list in the same way that I can think of, with those kind of connections. You know, he hasn't taken the kind of well-worn routes to life outside racing stability. You know, Sir Alex Ferguson, when he was managing Manchester United Football Club, would always urge his best players to get married as quickly as possible so that their home lives were settled and they weren't out Eddie Irvining their way around Manchester of the evenings. Vettel has very much followed the Michael Schumacher route of laser focus on Formula One and the results. You know, everything you do in your life channel towards the racing to make it the absolute best it can be. But Hamilton doesn't do things in quite the same way, and I guess that's perhaps why even champions past who will understand some of it can't quite figure him out.
Well, we've now not just talked about football in this podcast, which is a small yellow light on the dashboard. We've mentioned Eddie Irvine twice. So can we move on to someone who can actually drive a Formula One car quickly? Charles Leclerc, perhaps? Ferrari's new Alpha.
Good choice.
Is the headline. Thank you. Someone who can actually drive a Ferrari quickly. Who would be a worthy Ferrari world champion should he cross that threshold at some point in the future? And, you know, we've just been busy doing the I Was Right dance over the Daniel Ricciardo and Glenn Beavis story. We can do a little bit of an I Was Right dance over our choice of headline treatment and the feature in F1 Racing this month about Charles Leclerc, because
delightful timing.
Oh, brilliant. Part of me thought, oh, you Wally, when Seb Vettel took him out this last weekend, and part of me thought, well, you know, that's worked out quite nicely in terms of our feature. So where is Leclerc going, and what's going to happen next? Because we've seen this last weekend is a pretty sizable Vettel meltdown.
Well, what's going to happen next is a big conflab at Maranello, and I imagine Mattia Bonotto is going to be smashing their heads together, saying, this can't carry on into 2020, lads. Sort it out. I think this is the third time since Monza that they're going to have had a meeting behind closed doors to sort out contretemps.
Yeah. Contretemps is a great word.
Yeah.
It's one we don't use quite often.
Yeah,
enough.
We need to use that more, actually, because there are a lot of contretemps in Formula One. Yeah.
Particularly at Ferrari. I mean, it goes back. It all goes back to the Italian Grand Prix qualifying session. And if we remember Leclerc's first win at Spa, they brilliantly executed on a difficult weekend following the death of Antoine Hubert, close friend of Leclerc. And Vettel very much played the dutiful team game. You know, the Ferrari approach, and it's outlined in this feature this year, is to effectively have two alpha drivers, two number ones.
Yeah. The alphabet, we call it. And yes. I had no input on that pun, no, I might add.
That was mine. That was all mine. I take ownership of that one. Have two number one drivers, but manage them in such a way that they will subjugate their own interests for the benefit of the team. It's having your cake and eating it, as Boris Johnson would say. Or I should call him Alexander de Pfeffel Johnson.
Yeah, Alexander de Pfeffel.
His name isn't really Boris.
No.
Winds me up when people call him Boris. But anyway.
It's a brilliant digression.
Yes, having your cake and eating it. And at Spa, it appeared that Ferrari had pulled this off, because it helps, obviously, they weren't really in championship contention. But Vettel happily played second fiddle, helped Leclerc beat Hamilton in that race narrowly to win. Then it came to Monza, and Leclerc was supposed to help Vettel have a toe in the final part of qualifying, which you remember was it descended into farce because of the go slow approach of some of the midfield runners.
But not a funny farce either. It was sort of, in farce
embarrassing
terms,
moment.
It was about like run for your wife levels of farce.
Woeful. But Vettel was extremely irked that Leclerc did not follow instruction to tow him. And therefore Leclerc got pole and Vettel didn't. And that, you know, created a lot of bother behind the scenes. Vettel had probably his worst race of the season, spinning off and then colliding with Lance Stroll. And things have never really recovered from that moment. And we saw the team orders Farrago in Russia, where Vettel basically ignored the plan to hand track position back to Leclerc. And they had to have a meeting at Maranello after that to clear the air. Everything we were told was fine from Japan onwards, and they haven't really had cause to come to blows since. But then, of course, we get to Brazil, and then Leclerc, again, I'm going to insert my authority. Remember, of course, he was designated number two at the start of the year because Ferrari hoped to fight for the championship, and they didn't expect Leclerc.
That
would
went
get,
well.
Exactly, yeah. Ferrari didn't expect Leclerc would get up to speed as quickly as he has done, but nevertheless he has. He flings it down the inside of Vettel with a brilliant move, but that's essentially saying, you know, I'm the top dog here. Vettel, to his credit, he hasn't lied down, rolled over and had his tummy tickled. He's fighting back. He's been much more comfortable in the car since Singapore. That update has solved some of the problems he's had, particularly with the front end of the car. And he's thinking, well, I'm not licked yet. I'm here for at least one more year. I'm going to show what I'm made of, why I'm a four-time world champion. But yeah, unfortunately, when it comes to the crunch, that absolutely
did come to the crunch.
Exactly, it did come to the crunch. It's those moments when, you know, you need this absolutely precise spatial awareness. I'm not saying it's easy, but yet again, Vettel just is found slightly wanting when the pressure's really on. And it looked almost identical to Turkey 2010 when he moved over on Mark Webber and took them both out of the race. It's not the first time at Ferrari that, you know, Vettel's gone wheel to wheel with somebody and ended up having a spin or clashing needlessly. And I think you could see, even in the heat of the moment, when he came on the radio and almost blamed Leclerc, what's he doing? He then immediately said sorry to the team. And his body language when he was outside the car, kicking the wheel, kicking the stones, and then saying almost nothing to the TV pen interviewers after the race, you could tell that he knew that he'd messed up. So on this occasion, not really six of one and half a dozen of the other, it's all Vettel's fault, but it's creating yet more tension behind the scenes at Ferrari and a needless loss of points. Okay, they've sealed their place in the Constructors' Championship, so it's kind of insignificant, but it's more important for what it says about the internal dynamic there heading into 2020. It's not going to be easy to manage.
It's funny how it only takes one thing to kick these things off, and then that momentum just builds, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's been an interesting year. The way that shift has occurred within the team where Leclerc has not come in as the young guy. He's going to spend a couple of years learning the ropes in Formula One. He knows he's been signed by the biggest team in Formula One. He's got a winning car, a winning budget. He's got a, you know, an amazing team around him. He knows this is his chance. He's going to grab it with both hands. I think the fact that, you know, with one race to go, Charles has had, what, 7 pole positions this year against Sebastian's 2, you know, the most poles of any driver this season, is just indicative of, you know, how that shift has manifested itself ultimately in speed and consistency. And Ben, to your point exactly around Vettel, his kind of brave defence of his number one status has just ended up being quite clumsy at times, and he hasn't been able to emphatically stamp his authority within the team because he hasn't been able to emphatically, you know, stamp his authority within the racing. That's the problem, and the mistakes have built, and it's hard not to feel for the guy. I mean, he's a 4-time world champion who, you know, for a while, everyone thought the battle would be Vettel versus Hamilton. Turns out that actually the battle has moved on to other people now. We want to see the Verstappen versus Hamilton battle, and Leclerc is in that battle. And Vettel somehow seems to be moving into a kind of twilight phase where these mistakes just are horrible. And for the money that they're both being paid, at the end of the day, there's a fundamental priority to avoid colliding with each other on a racetrack at any point in a race, never mind the closing stages. It's difficult to imagine that the conversations that Mattia Bonotto will be having with them will be in any way easy, certainly if he says what needs to be said, because it's, you'd really be banging some heads together following that.
He's very good about not sharing his emotions in public, isn't he? Like, there's lots of memes and GIFs going around the internet of Toto Wolff hammering the desk. And in an interview in a forthcoming issue of F1 Racing, Valtteri Bottas said he actually finds those really funny, those GIFs. Binotto, there is no footage of him physically assaulting a piece of furniture. And even at the weekend, when he just sort of took his headphones off and walked back into the garage, he did it with a certain type of grace, as if he knew that the camera was there watching his every move, and he just, like a great poker player, he wasn't going to give away the fact that he was furious with what had just happened.
He's a dispassionate engineer, isn't he? Almost a archetypal, and probably what Ferrari need. You know, we criticise them often for being too emotional and overreacting to negative situations. But, you know, whether Binotto is ultimately the right man to lead the team, will, you know, time will tell. But he's a cool, calm customer, and they need that, especially when there is so much, so much trouble going on, you know, in that team. Going back to the peak Vettel years, if you like, 2017 and 18, those were his chances really to assert himself in that battle with Lewis that you mentioned, Mark, and he didn't take them. And now there's someone else coming along who's a bit stronger than he expected, probably than Ferrari expected, but who knows in himself that he's got what it takes to be at the Hamilton Verstappen level. He had that kind of buzz about him in the junior formula, so it shouldn't be a surprise. And also, he's a young man in a hurry, isn't he? He's had some very, very, very challenging life experiences, you know, losing his father while he was racing in F2, losing his friend at Spa this year. He's not going to waste any time learning for 2 or more seasons off of Sebastian Vettel. He's going to get in there and smash him as quickly as he possibly can, because life's too short.
It does look as if he's erased most of the fundamental weaknesses of his technique this season, hasn't he? You know, the weaknesses in tyre management, the giving it a little bit too much of the beans in qualifying.
Those are the two key things, aren't they? I mean, Scott Mitchell's excellent feature outlines, in fact, that those two key elements have been what have created this problem in the second half of the season. You know, early on, he was driving the Ferrari like it was a Sauber, and he needed to go flat out in Q1 and Q2, and he had nothing left for Q3. So he's inverted that process. It's much more appropriate to being in a top car, and his qualifying form speaks for itself. And, you know, Mark, you outlined, you know, he's the top qualifier this year, undoubtedly, among the leading drivers. And in the races, I think it was Hungary just before the summer break, Ferrari weren't really in the fight there, but Vettel, despite qualifying behind Leclerc, beat him in the race, P2 purely on time management, and the clerk went away and realised, well, I've got to sort this out, and came back almost immediately. And at Spa, it was completely the other way around. And this is the extra challenge for Vettel and Ferrari. Leclerc is showing those signs of being a truly great driver, someone who makes, sure, he makes mistakes while he's inexperienced, but he doesn't really repeat them. You know, he learns from them and he eliminates them as quickly as possible. So he's only getting stronger all the time with every race he does, whereas Vettel seems to have plateaued. And it seems, again, you know, when he's really under pressure and someone's turning the screw, he just doesn't have it in his locker to react the right way.
The rusks come out the pram, don't they?
To some extent, yeah. And these kind of situations never end well either, do they? You know, Mercedes had their two alphas with Rosberg and Hamilton, and it was Rosberg's unexpected retirement that relieved that internal stress. And
it could have got worse, couldn't it, if he hadn't gone? Yeah.
It could have. And you know, the fact that Mercedes have made such a massive point of talking about the different driver dynamic between Hamilton and Bottas, and retaining Bottas to a large extent on the basis of that dynamic, despite him not really performing at the highest level, I would say, in his time at that team, shows that that is a stress they definitely don't wish to repeat anytime soon. And at Red Bull, you know, the rise of Verstappen led to Daniel Ricciardo eventually leaving that team after a very high-profile collision at Baku, amongst other things. And, of course, Vettel himself leaving Red Bull because Daniel Ricciardo came in and upset his apple cart. So I don't see how, and whether it's just naivety on Binotto's part or whether he really thinks he has a formula to do the impossible, I don't really see how he keeps these two drivers together without there being further contretemps.
Yeah, the contretemps and twins.
I think Ferrari underestimated the extent to which Leclerc would raise his game so highly in his first year. I think that they probably thought there was a learning curve, and it turns out, exactly to your points, Ben, he's learned from the mistakes that he has made. He's learned very quickly. He's applied them. The underlying speed has always been there. And just as Max Verstappen had, you know, a difficult time first part of 2018, eventually sort of calmed down, learned from the mistakes. Some of them were, you know, pretty embarrassing mistakes. You improve and you come back as a better driver. And Charles was already starting from a pretty high level. So I think anyone at Ferrari who thought, okay, right, well, let's, you know, we're going to have 2 years where Sebastian's going to be the lead driver, supported by this young up-and-coming guy who's going to learn the ropes over the next 2 years. That strategy has been blown apart by the fact that Charles is just so damn quick and has learned so quickly. And it doesn't bode but well for 2020, because fundamentally those two drivers are not going to be, you know, giving way.
They're not going to change, are they? I think they've shown repeatedly this year that they're
not going to change.
They've drawn their line in the sand, and it's like
the Ocon and Perez thing, isn't it? You know, so they're going to have to be separated somehow.
Yeah, and of course the big problem is Mercedes, to a large extent, could manage their alpha problem because they had by far and away the quickest car. They didn't really have the odd race as you know time went by, but they didn't really have a proper challenge from a rival team. So it was just about those two drivers. Ferrari, unless next year's Ferrari is by far and away the best car on the grid, and Verstappen and Red Bull and Hamilton Mercedes can't get a look in, they can't really afford for these two to just go at it hammer and tongs. I accept Binotto's argument that it helps raise the bar of the whole team and helps push each driver to a higher level. That's fine while you're building up, but when you're trying to execute a drivers and constructors championship, they're going to take each other off again. They're going to lose points. Or they're going to start doing things where they come in at the wrong time for fear of being screwed over by the other driver or the strategy, and you'll let your rivals in through the back door.
The worst scenario that is just in recent history is Hungary 07 with Alonso and Hamilton, when you have drivers who not only trip each other up on track, but they're actually doing it in the pits as well. So it's pretty difficult, but it must be harder.
And they threw away that championship, undoubtedly.
Yeah. This is the thing, isn't it? When you look at what happened with Perez and Ocon, Force India managed it by saying to those drivers, if you two keep hitting each other on track, then we are going to take proactive steps to ensure that you two do not rival each other for the same piece of real estate. So if it means changing a gearbox so that one of you takes a five-place grid penalty, we will do that. You can't do that if you're Ferrari because you're fighting for the world championship and you need both cars to finish at the front. You need to be scoring 1-2s. So they don't have that particular weaponry in the armoury, do they? Because they can't do a tactic like that.
Very difficult to know how they manage it, especially because in the heat of the moment, you know, Leclerc and Vettel are both ruthless champion drivers. You know, they are going to put themselves first. And then, you know, following that maxim that it's always easier to seek forgiveness than ask permission. I mean, yeah. That is how they race, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, it's interesting. You're talking about sort of Alonso, Hamilton 2007. And for those of us a little bit older, we remember the utter lunacy that was Williams losing the World Drivers' Championship in 1986 with Alain Prost.
Mansell
and Piquet. And there was a time, I don't know if it's the same now, but there was a time that when you would go round the Williams factory, that in the museum, the only model where they had both cars from a single year was 1986, which was the FW11. And if you asked, I remember Patrick Head saying to me, you know, can you spot the difference between the two cars? One said Mansell, the other said Piquet. You couldn't spot any difference until Patrick points out that Nelson got the Williams team to make a smaller roll hoop. And he then proceeded to tell Nigel that gave him better airflow to the rear wing. And it just blew Nigel's mind that, you know, Nelson, because he was smaller, might be getting a little bit more airflow to the rear wing. I mean, that was the lunacy that was having two alpha male, you know, in the team going for it. And they lost the championship. So, you know, I think they both were, they had 69 and 70 points, and Prost ended up with 72, and that was it. So, you know, you've got a sport where we're not seeing anything new. We've seen it all before. We know when you get these two alphas together, you're going to have problems. And, Ferrari, I don't envy the job that Mattia Binotto has to do over the next year, frankly.
Speaking of over the next year, should we have a quick look at 2021? Because that's covered off in our insider section. And now that Formula One's actually got around to publishing let's not call it the final shape of the 2021 regulations, because there's still a lot of TBAs and TBCs and TBDs in there.
I's to cross and T's to dot, you might say, Codders.
Indeed, yes. There are plenty of those. And I suppose one of the biggest, the elephant in the room, as it were, quite apart from the technical regulations, is the budget cap, because this has been tried before. It hasn't worked. It was tried before as a gentleman's agreement, and Ross Brawn said, well, there aren't that many gentlemen in this paddock. So I suppose the first question we have to ask is this $175 million a year figure actually reasonable? I mean, are they setting the bar too high? Is that more than the smaller teams would want to spend? Is that kind of kicking the can down the road by saying we've got a budget cap, but actually it's a lot more than anyone would really spend?
Well, it's a step in the right direction, isn't it? Because I think all the midfield teams, probably including McLaren and Renault, unless they went and secured some extra resource from their respective boards, wouldn't quite make that limit. Certainly the other midfield teams wouldn't get anywhere near that for a yearly spend, but it is significantly less than Mercedes, Ferrari and Red Bull currently spend. So even if you can't quite get up to that level as a midfield team, it is going to peg the top teams to a certain extent. So it might not be perfect, but it's a nice compromise between where the midfield teams would want it and what the top teams are spending. You know, everyone's going to always want the budget cap to be what they are spending. The bigger question is it going to be enforced properly, and how will it be enforced? Because as you mentioned, Codders, it's not the first time Formula One has tried to go down this road, but it is the first time that it's been enshrined in regulation. So there's clearly a renewed determination to make this work.
It's interesting, isn't it, that one of the architects is Nigel Kerr, who was the CFO at Braun GP. Back in
referenced in your excellent feature with Nick Fry.
Oh yeah, indeed. So it's being it's being designed, this system, by people who have been at the coalface and know how things work. So I suppose you have to assume from that point of view that there is a level of competence behind it that maybe that there hasn't been before.
Yeah, Nigel's a very clever guy. I mean, it's interesting that you know, they managed to get him in because, as you say, he's been on the other side of the fence, and that's really important. I think in my view on the budget cap, to Ben's point, it's a move in the right direction. There are a great many teams who are really not going to have to worry about it because they haven't got anything like that amount of money to spend as it stands. Anyway, I think the other thing is that when you look at the exemptions from the budget cap, which, I mean, it's been interesting that people have said, well, it doesn't include driver's salaries and it doesn't include the marketing costs and it doesn't include the pay of the top three highest paid employees in the team. Slightly amuses me, that one, but anyway, you can just imagine the meeting where they're all sitting around the table and someone says to the team principals, you're going to have to be within the budget cap, and they go, oh no, we're not, we want the right to earn as much as we possibly can. So they all go, can we have a show of hands? All the hands go up. So that they've kind of looked after themselves. So you keep reading those kind of three areas. But when you start looking at all the other areas, engine development and production, flight costs and hotel costs for the races and testing. I mean, think about that, flights and hotel costs for races and testing. World Championship entry fees, property costs, finance costs, legal activities. I can tell you the legal bill of a Formula One team annually, it's a substantial six-figure, sometimes seven-figure sum if you're involved in disputes of any kind. Doesn't include HR costs, doesn't include social security costs, which exceed a certain level.
I mean, once you start, PAs at 200 grand a year.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
PAs at 200 grand a year. It doesn't include depreciation and amortization of, and these are sort of accounting terms, but sorry to say, but in accounting terms, it all flipping well adds up. when you think about driver salaries of a top team, and then you think about those employee salaries and all those other, I went through it, and I ended up kind of getting to sort of $300 million.
Oh, you're well over.
Oh,
you're well over. You're going to be thrown out of the championship.
That's what you will end up spending within the budget. So the budget cap of 175 won't cover the other 125 because of the exemptions. That's the point. Hmm. You will still be able to spend a huge amount of money on Formula One. I think...
Because this covers the aerodynamic development and the parts building and the aero testing and R&D and all of that kind of stuff.
Exactly. So the budget cap is a budget. I mean, the optics around it are really interesting. It looks like a huge shift. I'm not sure the extent to which it really is. I think it's also really interesting that since the regulations were announced, the three big teams, Red Bull, Ferrari and Mercedes, have each come out with pretty well the same messaging to say this is not the end point. This is the starting point. So they clearly feel that there is scope for further development and further moves on all of this. And it's interesting when you hear someone like, Franz Tost, team principal of Toro Rosso, say that, he actually thinks the impact of this budget cap and won't in any way, shape or form be seen until about 2023, because he said what's going to happen is in 2020... all the big teams are going to throw a vast amount of resource into front-loading their development for 2021 and 2022. So Franz Tost's view is it won't be until you see the field in 2023 that you will actually have any indication of whether the costs have had a balancing effect on Formula One at all. And I think that's a really important point. Once again, we're into a conversation about unexpected outcomes of the decisions that are made.
Well, maybe in this case expected, because it sounds from what you're saying, if indeed so much is exempt that actually the cap makes little or no difference even to the top teams, then it's more a headline grabbing exercise of saying we are limiting spending without really in reality limiting spending. And then actually the key parts of the rules package become not the budget cap, because it's the most unusual, but actually the more granular things on the technical and sporting side, such as limiting the race weekend to 3 days from four, not allowing teams to run a different spec of car than the one they scrutineer for Friday practice, limiting the potential of the aerodynamic services, trying to make the cars easier to follow each other, which is essentially taking away downforce. You know, they're targeting, I think, a return to sort of 2016 levels of lap time.
Mm-hmm. It's like the last three seasons have never happened.
Yeah, well, exactly, and that's prompted Sebastian Vettel to say that it's going in the wrong direction, and that actually the 2017 and subsequent cars were the right thing for Formula One. So they're going to become a lot slower again, and people are going to start moaning that actually they're
heavier
too slow.
As well.
Heavier, yes. So that doesn't go away. But these things are going to be the things that, in the end, have a greater effect on whether it's a closer championship or not, because I presume the intention will be that those rules will be so restrictive that all of this extra money you can still spend on the car won't actually make the same difference that it used to, and therefore the field will be closer just because development, etc., is limited.
You'd hope that would be the case, wouldn't you? How do you think that this figure or this system might be circumvented, and how does the punishment really have teeth? Because we've had in the past few weeks a very interesting parallel case in the stick and ball sports world, where Saracens, the rugby team that's very successful over the past 10 years, they're the Heineken Cup champions.
Oh, so football and Irvine aren't allowed, but rugby is allowed.
Because it's relevant.
Yeah.
Because it's relevant in this case. Very successful team. And they've been caught cheating the salary cap, and the means of achieving that is to have co-investment vehicles between the owner and the players that in effect enable them to be paid more than the salary cap. So so-and-so's mum owns a coffee shop, so-and-so has a company that owns a £300,000 flat in Lewisham, etc., etc. And they've been fined £5 million and had 35 points deducted from their total. A lot of people view that as being quite a toothless punishment, because you've still got a team full of internationals. They had 9 people on the pitch in the World Cup final, so, and they will have that team for the rest of this season. So if a Formula One team now front loads its costs, they're going to be enjoying that competitive advantage through 2021, 2022, maybe even 2023, as Franz Tost said. So is it even worth doing?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, someone said to me recently, it'll be interesting to see how many marketing executives of Ferrari have degrees in computational fluid dynamics. I think what's interesting is when you look at... Well, so let's take Mercedes-Benz and Ferrari, for example, because they happen to produce all their engine technology in-house. And when you see that the exemption is engine development, you think, well, so what else could you throw into engine development, which would then mean that you can use that as an excuse for additional people, additional cost. So engine development, engines today, what's that? That's actually the powertrain. So the powertrain means all the hybrid system, the battery, the control systems, software technology. You could argue it's all about fuel and lubricant systems, all about cooling systems. And of course, we know all of those systems have a huge effect on aerodynamics in terms of how much cooling you need. So actually, once you start looking into it, I think this is where Nigel Kerr and the guys who put all of this together, undoubtedly they will have looked at all of the potential loopholes, but there's bound to be some degree of clarification constantly required. And I think really stupid attempts to cheat the system by filtering money through other companies, or setting up a subsidiary business, or even setting up a completely separate company in another country to try and divorce it. All of those sort of things will get spotted fairly quickly. And the other thing is, if they don't get spotted quickly, it only takes a disgruntled employee to point the rules, the regulators in the right direction, and all of a sudden there'll be a big embarrassment. So I don't see that any of the teams will do anything to cheat the system exactly, but I think what they will do is, as they do with the technical regulations, where they look at what the rules say and then they look at what the rules don't say. They'll do exactly the same with these. They'll say, what does it cover, what does it not cover, and they'll exploit the opportunities to innovate in terms of spending money. So I'm not sure the big teams will be hugely as hugely affected by this as some people might think.
We'll be getting these weekly or monthly clarifications through from the FIA, just like we do in the technical directives, I suppose, won't we?
FDs, financial directives.
Which we won't be able to understand. We'll need you to come and do special one-off podcasts to explain the, you know, the party of the first part and the sanity clause. Oh, no, no, you don't fool me. There ain't no sanity clause. There you go. Sorry, Groucho Marx reference. Anyhow, I think we've come to about the end of our permitted slot, so it's time to close this nonsense down for another month. We might just go on hiatus, who knows? It depends on the extent to which those T's are dotted and I's crossed over the coming weeks. But we look forward to coming together soon for another Flat Chat podcast. In the interim, I've been Stuart Podling. Mark Gallagher has been Mark Gallagher. Thank you very much, Mark.
Thanks very much. Great to talk to you guys.
We'll speak to you in another month or so from Australia, assuming the broadband works over there. And
look forward to it.
We might just be enjoying our free broadband courtesy of Jeremy Corbyn by then.
Corbyn
fibre. And to my right, Ben Anderson, thank you very much.
Thank you, Codders. A pleasure.
Flat Chat is currently a Motorsport Network production. The producer was Martin Lee. Don't forget to subscribe to F1 Racing and keep us all in jobs for the foreseeable. Thank you.